New schools, underfunded departments, better roads and a new bus station are on the wish lists of MHK's Joni Farragher and Michelle Haywood. Both join me to explain how these commitments can be paid for, and halfway through their current term, are they delivering on their election promises? Joni Farragher, is it at times a struggle to get things done?
Well, absolutely there are things that I think I'm struggling to achieve, and it wouldn't be honest to say otherwise. It's very slow moving in government. I think the expression that I've heard quite a lot is wading through treacle, and that is exactly the sort of sentiment that I would express about it, really. It's surprising how slow moving things are, and I'm trying to think of a kind of example, I suppose, and one that comes to mind is that it was in my manifesto to try to make some effort to reform the DOI to make it more aligned with what people expect of it and the needs of the population. And that has been something that's been discussed in Parliament by the Chief Minister and by the Minister. And yet we have yet to see any kind of update, really, in terms of how that would look. And it's very difficult, really, to get to pin any action down, to be totally honest. So yeah, I would say that I am it's slower than I thought. It's a very slow pace in government, but I'm hoping that having reached the halfway mark, we've all got that kind of momentum behind us and we've got a little bit more experience, and I would say that maybe there's a little bit more targeted questioning going on, and hopefully that will result in some more movement from government.
So what sort of changes were you hoping to see with the DOI? What things were you looking for? Because like reform of planning, lots of MHKs get elected based on they're going to sort out the planning system, and then when they get in, they're not entirely clear what it is that they want to sort out.
Well, yeah, planning is obviously a DEFA function, but to answer your question about the DOI, that's a complex question, because actually the first thing that we need to establish is what should be the core functions of a Department of Infrastructure. And then we need to establish how we would look to meet those core functions, and what are the functions that are outside actually of its remit that it currently does hold, and what should the budget look like that would meet the needs of those functions, etc. So it's not a question that I could actually answer, because I would need that kind of review, I suppose, or that oversight in place first of all before we could establish what actually needs to change. But the biggest thing for me at this point would be bus vanning, and I think that, you know, that isn't in alignment. In many ways we have an excellent bus service. I use it regularly. It's clean at the moment. It's reliable. But there are parts of the island that are completely cut off. There are parts that really need that service that are cut off. There are parts that are low income, where people really do need that bus service. So, you know, that would be one thing that I would be quite keen to get that. And of course, to bring it back to one of my topics, we do not have a bus station in our capital. So those sorts of things, I think, you know, the DOI really does need to pull its finger out.
Michelle, have you had a chance, now that we are halfway through, to look back at your manifesto and think, maybe I need to put a bit more work into this, or perhaps you've ticked all the boxes and everything in the Russian garden is rosy?
God, if I could be halfway through a term and have ticked all the boxes, that would be really going it, wouldn't it? Probably not ambitious enough as a manifesto. No, I think there's clearly still stuff in there that I'm working on. You know, an all-island waste strategy just is so needed. And we see this at local levels, because you see things like the Southern Amenity site doing away with its reuse centre. And then I see it in a departmental level. So within DEFA and within DfE, we're seeing problems with construction waste and how we deal with that. And actually something that's overarching is still there. It is something I'm battling away at. And as Joni said, you know, sometimes it is little bit like wading through treacle, but actually there's some quite complex discussions to be had. But I think work is going on within the departments to kind of progress that, and pressure's being put on to move it along. It's, I think, across all departments I'm in, we struggle sometimes for resources to do things. So where we need legislation changing, it just takes a long time of ploughing through some really complex documents to actually get to the point where you make a difference. And I think I almost feel a bit missold on that, because I landed into DEFA at a point where an animal welfare bill was pretty well progressed. And there were a few policy decisions to make early on, but actually one of the first things I managed to do in the first year was bring the animal welfare bill through, and given its checkered history and failed attempts in the past, really proud to have been involved in that. And I think I kind of believed that it would all be like that, and I'd carry on being able to bring changes through at that sort of pace. And it seems to have slowed down a little bit, but I think it's particularly when you look at things like capacity legislation and health, it's because it's so complicated and it's important to get it right that we need to take the time working through. So although it's been promised for the last part of 10 or 12 years, you know, we need to get it right as it comes through now, so that it's actually a functional piece of legislation.
So, I mean, you mentioned the waste strategy there. You'd think that that should be a relatively straightforward and easy thing for a department to do. I mean, what is there to say, really? I mean, you need to recycle these things, and you need to find a way of reducing the amount of the other things. And if when you can't reduce them, then they either go into the incinerator or they go into a landfill. Surely that shouldn't be that hard to
do. It's one of those that causes quite a lot of conflict. So you've got in the Environmental Protection Unit, and they'll tell you there are something like 72 different types of waste that they categorise. And then I challenged the DOI minister on this, Minister Thomas, when he was in post, and he's thoroughly sticking to the they only have responsibility for household waste. They don't have responsibility for anything else. And actually, that's just not a joined up strategy. And we know that different local authorities operate different household waste regimes. If you're in the sort of the big urban settings, you can do curbside. It works financially. If you're in the more rural settings, that clearly doesn't work. And we need to think of something different to do that. And then there are questions about what's the market for recyclates, and, you know, what does it cost us to ship paper and cardboard across to the UK to be processed again and into something usable? How much fossil fuel do we waste shipping it? Would we be better off burning it, getting the energy? And you know, there's lots and lots of parts to it. And I think DOI haven't really addressed their part of it. I know Environmental Protection are putting pressure on them, and we're talking about whether the landfills are engineered in the right way and whether they're fit for purpose. And actually what we need is an overall strategy that allows our local authorities to fit in with what's best overall. And so if you're in a smaller local authority that can't offer some of these recycling services, that there's a joined up approach to it.
I suppose the other thing, of course, is the incinerator, or the energy from waste plant, as we're probably still supposed to call it. At some point, that's going to reach the end of its useful life, and presumably an alternative solution needs to be found, because I'm guessing that burning waste isn't going to fit in particularly well with carbon emissions strategies and targets.
No, there's pressure coming that on that from all sides, isn't there? And it, you know, now you're right. Now is the right time to start talking about what does that replacement look like. We went on a trip down to Guernsey, and they were very proud to take me to show me their recycling centre. And it turned out they had about 20 different skips, so you could recycle various different things that were then obviously shipped off for reprocessing elsewhere. But then pretty much all their household waste went through a big chipper and got bundled. And I said, OK. And they said, so we've got zero waste going through here. Excellent. So where does it go? And they shipped it from there to the UK, across the UK in a lorry, from the UK across to Sweden. And then it went into an incinerator in Sweden. And so it didn't count for their carbon emissions because it wasn't generated on their soil. And they're busy boasting. And I think we have to be careful that we don't create something that's equally false. We need to be responsible for our waste. The biggest thing we can do is obviously reduce the amount of waste we're producing. But we need to be responsible in how we deal with it and how we process it as well. And those forward-looking conversations need to happen.
You've both mentioned the wading through treacle description of how government works or barely works, I suppose, might be another way of putting it. What do you think can change, or what needs to change, to actually speed up the pace of government? Because it can go quicker. There are examples of governments around the world which seem to be much more efficient and effective. Joni?
Well, firstly, I think we our experience of things being so slow will be because we're backbenchers, and obviously the ministers have a quicker route to change things if they want to. We've seen that with the gas legislation that recently went through, that was, you know, kind of read in one day. But equally, there are lots of sort of elements of bureaucracy that we've put in place. And I have wondered before whether all of it is, strictly speaking, necessary. But also, we don't have a political party system, so we do have to reach consensus, first of all, which takes such a long time. And I really do think that, genuinely, obviously, I'm in a political party, so I do, you know, but there's a good reason that I'm in a political party. And I feel like it's important to sort of get the information out there that that does hold us up, that we don't have any consensus whatsoever. We have 24, well, we've got two Manx Labour Party MHKs, but other than that, and often we'll have 24 MHKs who have completely different perspectives, completely different priorities. You never know what way they might vote on an issue because they don't have any, manifesto or sort of ethos to fall back on. So you can't really predict how people will vote. This all takes a lot of time. So consensus building, first of all, is this huge obstacle in our way of getting anything done.
We are 2.5 years into this government's plan, and it would appear that we have lots and lots of reports and glossy brochures, but it's difficult for people like myself, even, who follow politics in some depth, to point to any significant change as a result of the last 2.5 years of government. Michelle, I mean, well, first of all, are you ready to join Joni's party? Secondly, how do you think that we could start to speed up the pace of government?
I think I have some sympathy with the party argument, that, you know, but actually I think it leads to a more stable government. And if you talk to some of our, you know, some of our senior civil servants who did work in Westminster, you know, they'll say there's an election, there's a change of government, and then everything changes and everything they were working on pretty much gets trashed out and they start again from the beginning. And actually, I think we get a certain continuity in what we're doing by the fact that we don't have that grand switch to occur. And I think that in some ways that's part of the stability of the island and the governance, although it does lead to this inertia. But I think actually some of the inertia is that some of what's being tackled now are difficult problems that have been around for years. So if you look at things like the Capacity Act, you know, we've trailed that for 10 years. We're looking at the Regulation of Care Act. That's been trailed since the last administration. It was just never done because it was considered too hard and too difficult and too many resources. And I think there was a clear steer from this administration when it started up that we looked at those difficult to do things, and we're actually getting through some of them, but they were difficult to do because they take time, and but they're so necessary. And like improving our Regulation of Care Act, it's going to have a new name, but as that comes through, effectively looking at those services and how we make sure that the services that people are getting are good quality and well run, that's really important. But it's just the legislation we're working with is so out of date. And you look at harbours legislation on small boats, for example. We're dealing with legislation there that predates the Titanic, and it's never been updated in all that time. So there isn't even a requirement to have life jackets on board. You know, we are so far behind on some of this. There's just almost a backlog that creates that problem.
Sorry, I must just pick up on some of the comments earlier on there about, because I think this is a lot of the misconception around political parties, that we would therefore have to follow the Westminster system or the UK system of first past the post, which does create that kind of wild oscillation from one ideology to the other and doesn't build consensus. We don't have to do that. I would not advocate for that. I would advocate more for a proportional representation system that would actually make parties have to build consensus with each other, and that, you know, there is no reason that we would have to follow the UK in that. And I think that is a lot of our misconception around political parties, is when we look at the UK, they're actually an outlier politically in terms of their system. It's not a very representative system, and I certainly wouldn't advocate for that.
Good. And I suppose the other thing that you raised there, Michelle, I mean, perhaps it's not a bad thing that every 5 years there is a radical shake-up. Maybe that's something that's needed. Certainly, People who've been around in politics for a long time will know that actually the personnel change, but the government stays remarkably similar in terms of Isle of Man government. And maybe it is time that we did have a bigger change.
I think that there's pros and cons, isn't there? There's the, you know, we certainly know that some of that stability is why people like doing business with the Isle of Man, because of that. But we equally know we can move fast when we want to. It's just a question of whether we throw the resources into that. I move fairly fast on things like the vaping legislation and the gas regulations. But actually, that took a load of resources away from other things that were ongoing. And so there's always that balance to be struck about what your priorities are at the time.
We'll find out a little bit more about how priorities could be divided up after the break. You're listening to MHK's Joni Farragher and Michelle Haywood. One of the complicated, difficult things that have been talked about for a long time but never really changed, one of those, of course, is rate reform. And another one, of course, is local government reform. Neither of these are even on the wish list of this current government. And yet, we've just had significant overspends by most of the big spending departments. We had last year a very significant, it was $170 million black hole in the finances. Yes, we hear from the Treasury Minister that there's a $40 million increase on tax, but that's been completely wiped out by the overspends. Surely rate reform is something that should be high on the list of any government, particularly one that's in the financial constraints that our current government is. I don't know who wants to. Joni, would you like to have a go at that?
Yeah, well, we were actually talking about this at the Manx Labour Party meeting last night, and there was some input from people who've been politically active on the island for many years, who've got that institutional memory, and it was quite interesting to hear really that, to hark back to my former comments, that actually consensus building had been so difficult when this has been brought through or attempted in the past, that the fact that there are several Douglas MHKs that would like to see, obviously, an All-Ireland rate, and then the more rural MHKs kind of don't reflect that view, and there is the consensus has never been able to be reached within Tynwald on this matter. So due to the complexities, and I think it's taken up a lot of parliamentary time and nothing's actually come of it, I can imagine that might have input into why this administration, why this Council of Ministers has not decided to prioritise that.
Local taxation is amongst the lowest in the surrounding countries. If we looked across the whole of the British Isles and Ireland, we have the lowest local taxation.
Yeah, and I think every commissioner's, especially, you know, when we do have local elections kind of looming up, every board of commissioners will have sat there and tried to keep their rates rises to the lowest possible. I think the issue has started to come up again, because obviously with the recent sort of threats over closing the Southern Pool and what that leisure rate looks like. I know there's been lots of discussions, and it cuts across whether it's Douglas-based MHKs or it's the more rural MHKs, that it's cut across that actually we think there should be something much fairer in terms of how you pay for those leisure facilities. So the concept of an all-island leisure rate has resurfaced. We know that Douglas and Braddon and Onchan and Garth are not paying into pool provision. I noticed with a puzzled look, actually Ramsey commissioners decided to put 6.1 pence rate in for their pool, which they'd resisted that rate going up, but they've obviously seen the need to carry on supporting that. And I think in light of everything that's happened down south, I kind of welcome that. But it does come into the overall mix. And I think even when we were discussing in the early days of the island plan, what was going to be in there, this was put in the too hard to do pile and stuff. But I think there's a building head of pressure, and it won't happen. It's not in the island plan. There won't be any resources put towards it. But I think that pressure is building, that things do need to change. So I suspect it's probably one of those that's parked for the next administration to pick up.
Certainly the Treasury Minister is indicating that his new tax strategy doesn't even talk about rates. Do you think that's a missed opportunity, Joni?
Well, again, I think as it's not in the island plan, and as it has used up so much parliamentary time in the past with no resolution, I can understand that. But it kind of it does feel a bit like a missed opportunity, in terms of the fact that because it's hard to do doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it, I guess. And that's kind of where I would start at. And we could consult on this and maybe go with the consensus of the general population, whilst appreciating that actually, you know, I think it might be good to have an overview of what would actually be the fairest way to do this, rather than what is your opinion on what we should do for your constituency. And I think maybe if we could sort of look at it from that angle and that perspective, instead of a sort of I'm protective of my constituency, which is what tends to happen whenever we've had this debate in the past.
We have a budget coming up in a week or so's time. All the Tynwald members have had the opportunity to have a Tynwald briefing, so you will know pretty much what's in that budget. I'm going to ask you to go into the worlds of make-believe a bit and pretend that you don't know what's in the budget. What are the things that you would have hoped to see in this forthcoming budget? And Michelle, I guess I know what one of the things on your list is.
You could have several things off my list. I think last year's budget was a missed opportunity because actually they didn't reflect where pay rises were clearly going to go. And that leads to you to the overspend and the supplementary vote that's coming up as well. So I would hope that this year they've done some sensible numbers in there. I can't, you know, kind of look and you think, well, you knew where things were going last year. It was obvious. I'm glad to see the Bank of England are predicting that inflation will drop to 2% by the spring. We'll mirror what happens in the UK. So I think that sign takes the pressure off. Obviously, Castle Rushton High School needs to be there in the capital spend. We need to get beyond this design stage that I think the proposal is going to be 2 years for designing it. Genuinely can't see how it's going to take that long to work through.
And what you've seen so far, because the you know, the minister appears to at least have a master plan which shows a school and shows a swimming pool in it, and there's talk of a speeded up time frame so that the whole thing could be finished, or at least the school could be finished by 2028. Are these warm words, or is there some real hard fact behind this now?
I don't think you could call a single document with a picture on it a master plan. It clearly doesn't make sense, even if you look at it, because the new school overlaps where the existing school is, and you need to have a functioning school during a build. So as far as that document is concerned, if that's what there is to show after 2.5 years, it's not good enough. It genuinely isn't. So I'm really not going to put much store by that. I think the new way of managing capital projects so that we can vote on them during the year and that they're taken over and are effectively run by that major projects unit and the department just becomes the client that throws the specification out there is the bit that we need to focus on. And I hope that that system can be embedded going forward, because I don't have much faith in the department in being able to deliver this. We've had 10 years of being promised a new school. I really do want to see it move forward, and I want to see that in there. And I guess the other bit that I want to see in there is the capital works on Portsmary High Street, which is so disastrous as a stretch of road now. I'm going to be planting spring bulbs in there next week if they carry on not doing anything about it.
Joni, I guess the Labour Party will have a very clear plan for what it would like to see in the next budget.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to go back to Manx Labour Party's manifesto, one of the things that we've been keen to see for many years is some sort of progressive taxation in place that would reduce inequality on the island, as well as lifting the tax cap. And as you might know, I have asked Treasury in the past how many people the tax cap is applied to and what the benefits are, and wasn't able to get any kind of numerical figures around that, which is quite baffling actually. So yeah, I think those two would be, and in the future economic strategy we do have the sort of ethos that we need to reduce inequality using the taxation system, so that would kind of be at the forefront really. But in terms of more granular detail, I suppose Michelle's mentioned the capital project of the school there, and in my constituency there hasn't been a suitable primary school, two-formentary primary school, for many years. Obviously Scotland Jubilee, far too small for its pupil role. It depends on temporary accommodation for a lot of the pupils. The Park Road site's been vacant for so long. We've had two conflicting answers from the minister as to whether the site is suitable for a two-formentary school. I would like to see an objective review of what priority each capital project is right now, and that to me is a job that's long overdue, and that our constituents in Douglas aren't being served appropriately there. So there's quite a lot of other things that I would like to see in the budget. If you want me to carry on,
this is your programme, so please do.
So I think what we haven't seen very much movement on is the suicide prevention strategy. I would have liked to have seen some allocation financially for the actions of that.
The one thing that neither of you have mentioned, and bearing in mind the scale of the difference between spend and income, you might have thought that this is something that should be starting to trouble MHK's minds, is how do we rebalance government finances? The last budget suggested that the $175 million was miraculously going to drop to around half that in a year. Is there any real sign that that's going to happen? And are we basically looking at big spending priorities continuing and little significant progress being made in terms of working out how we're going to pay for this?
I think there's some encouraging sort of predictions coming through. You know, Treasury always underestimate what they're going to get in the way of income tax and NI, and that's the right way to do a budget, isn't it? Underestimate your income. So there's indicators that that's definitely gone up. And obviously the Island Plan and the economic strategy are predicated on growing that economically active section of the population and increasing your tax return as a consequence of that. It will be interesting to see, there was a prediction about what the drawdown on reserves would need to be, and that was tapering away. It will be interesting to see when you get to the end of this financial year as to where that actually comes out as and what the prediction is for the next financial year. I'm hoping to see that drawdown on reserves doesn't need to be as much. But we know that austerity budgets, which is your other choice, kill people. Austerity budgets do lead directly to deaths within the community. And that is definitely not something that I would be able to support. Cuts in services and cuts in benefits would be something that's completely a red line for me.
Joni, one of the scurrilous perhaps lines that's often used by candidates for the Keys are that we need to cut out the bureaucracy, cut out the middle management, and DHSC is one that's often referred to as having far too many managers and not enough front of house staff. Is that a problem? Is it something that can be reasonably done? Do you think perhaps Isle of Man government has become overly bureaucratic?
Okay, there's two separate questions in there. So first of all, has it become overly bureaucratic? And secondly, is it overstaffed? On that second point, is it overstaffed? I'd say it's quite the opposite, actually. We do struggle for resource. We do struggle to get projects done because of the fact that the workload is quite high. And certainly in my experience within the DHSC, it's a small department, actually. There is not enough kind of staff power to get through the workload often.
I think the Wright report bears that out as well. If you read the Wright report, it clearly shows that we were lacking in, once you had one or two key people away for various reasons, actually there wasn't enough senior management to really support decision making in the department. So, I think I'd defend the DHSC against that charge.
Is this down to priorities, though? Priorities both in terms of Tynwald members and department priorities, that perhaps we're... We have too much going on in departments, and maybe it's easy to say, but perhaps more difficult to deliver. We need to focus actually on what the core function of the department is and maybe cut out some of the nice-to-haves.
Well, I think the issue within the DHSC, and probably in other departments as well, not all, but in others, is that the remit is constantly widening, whereas the budget is not widening in line with that, and people's expectations are very, very high, considering that our taxation is actually quite a low kind of system. So I think we need to align those more closely, and in my view, obviously, I would expect that we would increase taxation in order to meet the needs of people in terms of public services. That would be my view, but it would be, I would love to get the public's more a more wider view on that, because I think we do hear a lot of competing expectations of the DHSC, and we have a lot of competing priorities, and obviously the general public have a lot of competing priorities. When the NHS was first envisaged, it certainly didn't include a whole raft of the work streams that are now considered to be within the health services remit. And actually, we do need to have a conversation about how to align those better.
Michelle?
I think there are departments that have looked. I know within DEFO, we sat down and we did a, right, what is everyone doing and should we be doing that? Is it a statutory requirement? Do we need it? In fact, in some cases where there were statutory services, we actually suspended them for lack of resource. And you sit and work through, historically, have you ended up doing things that actually, when you look at them, there's no really legal requirement for you to be doing it, and actually could be done by the private sector. And I think that's... I hope other departments have done a similar sort of function exercise. And I think that I can sort of say, hand on heart, that actually that's kind of, it leads to shuffling people around, it leads to changing roles, it leads to trying to use the resource that you have the best you can. Every department would like more, obviously. We'd like to be able to do more, we'd like to be able to step up and be proactive about things. And actually, government doesn't tend to be very good at looking long term, and we can look at even like biosecurity responses. We know if we act early on those, it heads off future problems, but we don't always have the resources to be able to act early enough, and so we just store up the problem further down the line. And so I think that there's almost a shift in thinking needed. I mean, I guess you can apply the same to climate change response. It's been kicked down the road for years and years and years. And we get to the point now where we are having to make some very tough decisions, and we will have to spend some money on it. But actually, if 25, 30 years ago, the money had been spent in different ways, we wouldn't be forced with those spending cut things now. So I think it's really difficult. What do you want to achieve? We only have a short life as politicians, don't we? 2.5 years, and we could potentially be not in the roles anymore. What are we trying to achieve in that? But actually, how do we set things up for long-term security?
One of the things in the Our Island plan is, or certainly the Chief Minister's mood music that surrounds it, is that we need to have more private sector investment in the Manx economy. There was talk of a need for £1 billion investment, 100 million of which would come from government, and the other 900 million was supposed to come from the private sector. One of the areas that you've mentioned there, of course, was moves in relation to meeting our climate objectives. And we know that there are several almost ready to go private sector renewable energy projects. Why is it that we apparently can give millions of pounds to developers to develop luxury flats, but we don't seem to be that keen on allowing private sector development in the renewable energy field?
I think there's some understandable reluctance to allow your energy generation to be in the hands of private providers. We've seen in the UK that privatising energy, whether it was British Gas or electric, it just didn't work for the good of the consumers, and it didn't work for the good of society in the long run. And so I absolutely understand why you wouldn't want to get into bed with private providers and then be beholden to them at whatever rates they're charging, whatever contracts that you've negotiated. Owning your own generation gives you control over it, means that you're always running it for the best of the people of the island.
But of course, it's then important to have that in place. It can't be, we don't want private, so we're not going to do anything. And I think that's kind of feels like where we sit at the moment, that I fully agree with Michelle there that I would not be kind of supportive of private energy generation in terms of our future. I would say, and in the Manx Labour Party manifesto, we do have a commitment to kind of community-owned renewable projects, which there's a lot of global precedence for this and how the benefits that it brings to people, but at the moment, it feels like, because of our reluctance to, we are rightfully reluctant to get private, to fund private developments in that area, but that we haven't actually that got the motivation or the impetus to get going with it publicly, in the public hands.
I think
either.
There's an issue with some of those private suggestions as well, that is that solar panels don't meet the energy mix that we need. They'll be great for demand in the summer when our demand is really low. They won't meet the 5 o'clock on a winter's night when our demand is really high. Mm. Solar panels are going to do nothing for us. And so although they're part of a mix of energy solutions, and lots of the private developments come through huge arrays of solar, it just doesn't fit with what we need. And I can't see why you'd get into bed with taking an energy supply that doesn't meet when your peak demand is going to be. It's just not the right strategy.
For nearly two centuries, we had a private sector firm effectively supplying the lifeline of sea transport to and from the Isle of Man. That seemed to work reasonably well. We then took it into public ownership, and perhaps it's not, certainly the last year or so, it doesn't seem to have been working quite as well as it did when it was in private hands. So perhaps some people will think government is short of money at the moment. Surely to goodness, if the private sector is willing to invest, and you know, you're the government, you can set all the rules and regulations, you can say that the energy must be delivered in such and such a form at such and such a time, and that there must be all these safeguards in place to make sure that you remain reasonably in control of this. It does seem that the arguments against private sector energy development are fairly flimsy.
I think there's two things to pick up on there. One is the steam packet might be in government ownership, but it's not in government management. So whatever issues they've had in the service they're providing, I think it's more, we expect more because it was in government ownership than it's delivering less than it was. And I don't think government necessarily is to blame for that, other than they haven't you know, addressed some of those problems or found a way to exert any influence on it. The board is doing what it does, and its problems are of its own accord. But I think the MUA, by contrast, which is a statutory board of government, have been delivering secure and stable energy. You know, we don't have power blackouts on a regular basis. We aren't worried about that, where that energy, we were worried about the cost of it when fossil fuels shot up in price and gas shot up. But, you know, generally, we've got a secure and stable energy supply that is run by government. And I think allowing them the access to renewable technologies to feed into that mix and to manage it is for the best of the island.
And this is the same MUA that borrowed substantial, some tens and tens of millions of pounds without the authority of Council of Ministers to do so. And latterly, we've seen, was it a 40 million overspend in their budget? Joanie?
Well, I just wanted to go back to your question earlier on there, because I actually think it's a little unfair to say that since government has taken over the steam packet, it's not been as viable as in the past. I think that trend was already well in evidence before the government took it over. And I think that actually expectations of profit margins have changed dramatically over the much more recent years and decades, but over the last two centuries, which is what you were talking about. And so I think it is a little unfair to sort of make that comparison that the government couldn't run things effectively because of the steam packet situation. And I'd also, you know, pick up on Michelle's words that actually we do successfully run the MUA. However, as you've just raised, there are historical issues with that. But what can we do from this point onwards, I think, is making sure that we inbuild safety measures that these sorts of issues don't crop up again. Have we ever achieved any satisfactory resolution of what happened with the MUA loan situation in the past? And do we feel comfortable that situation wouldn't occur again?
I think that's it, isn't it? It's about governance. And actually, we have, you know, you and I know because we've sat in DHSC, and you're managing that relationship with Manx Care, we hand over a huge amount of money to Manx Care as an organisation, and DHSC is sat there trying to govern the services that are provided, to regulate them, to inspect them, to check that they meet key performance indicators. You know, we hand our mandate over to Manx Care and we expect them to be delivering back on that. And you know, but setting the legislation when that was set up wasn't really clear about what levers we had and what buttons we could push in order to move things along. And I think it comes back down to, it was a great idea. Yeah, there's part of me still out on that. Whether Sir Jonathan Michael's right that this is the model, it still needs to be proven that this is the model. I think Manx Care could deliver on stuff, but I think the relationship and how those relationships worked out then for the department with the other people in the sector actually was never really clearly set out. And I that lack of governance almost feels like it's the same issue that happens with the MUA that allowed them to go and get big loans and government knew nothing about it. It's that lack of governance and that lack of establishing how things should be run and how involved government is and how much oversight and what the level of reporting is. I think it's really crucial. And we're obviously, there's the steam packet committee that's going to look at how that's structured. And those are things that have really been occupying me at the moment. It's how do you get that relationship right so that you're not interfering with professionals who are doing a job, but you're making sure that what they deliver is what the island actually needs.
You're both members, obviously, of DHSC and the biggest of the overspends that's going to Tynwald in February for approval came from your department. How long have you known the scale of this problem internally in the department?
So I need to correct your term there, because I do not agree that it's an overspend, it's an underfund. So that gives you your answer, actually, because this was projected, this was the amount that was requested in last year's budget. So that can give us all as an island a lot of confidence in Manx Care's figures there, because this is almost the exact same amount they projected they would need. So we have known for an awful long time and have been very vocal in trying to actually get that across to our political colleagues that you know, we cannot underfund health services. It is vital now that we really take forward that mindset that the more we continue to underfund health services, the more we will be focusing on acute care only, and we will not be putting money into early intervention, which we know is actually much more efficient and gives people better lives. And that's kind of what we're all about at the end of the day. But at the moment, it always has to be on the hospital, on acute care. And that's just getting bigger and bigger because we're not doing this work upstream.
But isn't this the same argument that would be trotted out by every department of government? I mean, DOI has a fair to middling case that its overspend could have been predicted because it was obvious that the energy costs were going to be significantly higher during the course of the year than they had in terms of a budget. So underfund, does that mean all the departments of government are underfunded, in which case the 175 million black hole in public finances suddenly becomes 225 million.
No, I think you go back to the Sir Jonathan Michael report, and he'd noted that healthcare services have been underfunded for years. I think this is where it comes really, really important to challenge Treasury on the assumptions that it's made going into any budget. Assuming that, you know, pay rises last year, I think they'd allow 2% in the budget. It was clear to us as we came to the budget time, but it's part of that budget cycle, isn't it? You know yourself, it starts in the summer and it runs all the way through until they've got a draft budget somewhere around Christmas time. But actually, there's a long time between there and when it gets announced and when it comes into effect. And in spring last year, we saw significant shifts and you could start to see pay rises coming through at a much higher rate. So I think it was always clear, especially in departments where you have a high level of staff and that's a large proportion of your costs, that you were going to be forced into much higher pay settlements than had been anticipated in the budget. So I think it was almost baked into the last budget that there were going to be overspends.
So perhaps what the Treasury was trying to do was, you know, in a nicely hidden sort of Treasury way, actually get a grip on expenditure and maybe put out a mindset that actually we can't carry on spending at this rate unless we can find a way of significantly increasing our income.
And I think that's kind of where I have arrived at the start of this administration, and where every single budget speech that I've made has really focused on, that we do need to align our incomings with our outgoings, and that you know, that to me is what progressive taxation should be all about, that the people whose shoulders can take that financial burden should actually take that instead of actually what we see right now, which is that the kind of middle earners pay far more as a percentage of their income than the top earners do. Now, do we actually all agree that that is right?
And the other thing, of course, is that companies on the Isle of Man pay next to nothing. I mean, they've got the benefit of two really good worlds. One is the tax, the income tax system, and the other one, of course, is the local taxation. There's as we've mentioned earlier, you know, rates are amongst the lowest anywhere in these islands.
And there's growing international pressure, isn't there, for companies to pay a fair share of taxation in the jurisdictions where they're domiciled. And I'm hoping Treasury are going to start listening. Well, they won't have a choice. They are going to have to start listening to some of that, and there is going to have to be movement on fair taxation.
Is it going to be too little too late, though? I don't know. Joni, what's your feeling on this?
I can see where your question comes from. I think that it's going to be a tough call for any politician to make, to say, look, we are actually paying, we're not paying very much compared to our counterparts in other jurisdictions, because every time there is any sort of movement on taxation, there is a public backlash. And that's why I think we need to start having these conversations much more openly, actually, that our incomings are not in alignment with our outgoings, and certainly not in alignment with our expectations of public services. And this is huge. This is a really, really big conversation that needs to be had with the public of the Isle of Man. What do we want out of public services? Do we want them to be world quality? Do we want them to be extensive and effective and efficient? Or do we want to actually have services that are in line with the taxation that we pay? Because at the moment, those two do not match.
And Michelle, and sadly, we are coming towards the end of the programme now. We are running out of reserves which have allowed us to gently manoeuvre through things like the COVID crisis. But the reserves are just not going to be there in another year or two's time to fund the expenditure we've all got used to, unless we can find some significant increase in income.
Obviously there's always going to be an eye on where your reserves are. We are unusual in terms of any government that we don't have massive debts and massive borrowing, and you can see that in the credit ratings that are commented on. Even compared to Jersey and Guernsey, you know, the significant debts for some of their sectors. So I think we have to be looking at that. I'm hoping that we'll see that draw on reserves coming down. You know, the prediction last year was that would taper away that demand, but it would be balanced out by increased revenue. And I hope we start to see the indicators of that coming through, because if that's not going to be the case, then there needs to be a rethink about where the economic strategy is heading.
We literally only have a few seconds left for each of you to tell us what you hope is going to be delivered in this 12-month period.
Okay, so in terms of my constituency, I would like to see some movement on the Park Road site, and I would like to see some movement on a 2-4 entry school, which is long overdue. I would like, if within the department, I would like to oversee the rollout of the autism strategy, maybe look towards parity of esteem for mental health issues, as well as moving towards the future of nursing residential costs. And in other issues, we will be debating the Liverpool John Moores report on the illegal substances, and I would like to see some movement on that. I would like to see a bus station in our capital, alignment of the bus services with needs, and a trial of Fair Free. And finally, we have the poverty report being debated in the spring, which I'm a member of. So,
Michelle?
Locally, the high street and the school and the pool and securing the future for those have got to be high on the list for things that my constituents are really worried about. I think if you start to look on a wider level, I don't want to see services cut, particularly in health services or education, and I think that's the bit where they should be core government services, and that we need to defend those, because actually they're dealing with the youngest in our society, and they're dealing with the sickest in our society, and I really don't want to see any movement there. I'm hoping that some of the actions that came out of the Population Rebalancing Committee, where we started suggesting things like levelling up on child benefit and things, and stuff that really supports families, will be there, and we can look forward to making a more family-friendly society.
Is the problem with government the rather clunky processes and systems, or lack of clear steer from those in the driving seat? Perhaps both. Can we afford to carry on with big government spending? More taxes or fewer services? Which would you prefer? This programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Got a Mayos and Geisha from. Thanks for listening.